Okay, they told me to talk to three before I started, to count to three before I started talking. I don't know why that is. This is Colin McEnroe. Do not adjust your radio. John Dankosky is not here, as I mentioned before. Yesterday, he was bitten by Luis Suarez. He's receiving medical. I think it's more the emotional shock than the actual infection. I think most of that can be controlled. So I'm here. This is The Wheelhouse. It's when we get together on Wednesdays to talk about the week in news. And so with us today, Daniela Altomare, one of the Capitol reporters and political reporters for the Hartford Courant. From the Connecticut Mirror is Mark Pazniokas, probably the record holder for Wheelhouse appearances, unless you count me because I'm here every week. And then, is this your first time? Zach Janowski making his debut here. He's an investigative reporter for the Yankee Policy Institute. Is it the Yankee Policy Institute or the Yankee Institute?
Yankee Institute.
Yankee Institute. All right. So that's who's here. We've got lots and lots of things to talk about. And as we talk and as you get interested in what we have to say, 860-275-7266 is the number to call. We're also going to be on CTN. Our friends from CTN are here right now. We'll be on right after the program Real Housewives of the Program and Investigations Review Committee, which happens to be really my favorite CTN show. So we're going to start with the always muddled state political scene. We're going to start actually with following the money a little bit. There's all kinds of things going on with money in the political scene and sort of allegations of how money gets used and how it gets spent. Daniela, one thing that you blogged about this week and wrote about a little bit was actually this will be the one chance we have to talk about the 5th District. In the 5th District, it turns out that when you're a congressperson, of course, you can send out a lot of actual physical mail. It's called – the privilege is called franking. Elizabeth Esty, who is the current incumbent, sends out a lot of mail, right? And her opponent, Mark Greenberg, doesn't really like that.
No, Greenberg is trying to make some traction here on this issue that, you know, she sent out over, I think it was over $200,000 worth of mail. It's not actually free. It's money that comes from her office. But it's, you know, it's taxpayer money, basically. And, you know, he positioned himself as a fiscal conservative. And, you know, he's hoping this kind of resonates with voters. You know, what those Congress people send out all this free mail, you know, it's just to publicize their own, you know, doings and make themselves look better. And Esty's saying, no, you know, we want to communicate with our constituents. It's important. So, you know, readers can kind of draw their own conclusions.
Well, the readers can draw their own conclusions. But past, not that it's a perfect correlation. But often it is the case that the volume of that franked mail that is to keep in touch with constituents and let constituents know important things that's going on seems to have a direct correlation with how hot a political race the person is in. I think Elizabeth Esty has sent out something like 10 times as much mail as anybody else in Connecticut. It could be she's just so excited about being a new congressperson.
Well, she's new, Colin, yeah. And she's excited about being in Washington. But yes, I think you have struck upon a reasonable correlation between competitive races and the activity on many levels that you see on the part of the people who hold competitive offices.
But there are restrictions. You know, this is overseen by, you know, House committees, and there are restrictions and there are certain guidelines that, you know, 90 days before an election or something like that, you know, you can't send out mail. I mean, there are – it's not just, you know, hey, I'm great, although it often seems that way when you read these mailers.
And I think we should also remember, you know, those of us who have received mail, whether it's from your local legislator or congressman, I don't know how persuasive that you found them or what difference it made. I'll just throw that one out there.
Well,
you know,
right.
Zach, one argument that gets used is, you know, just get rid of franking. I mean, we live in a digital age, not that everybody has digital access. I mean, there are inequalities there, but we live in a digital age. But, you know, there's no real reason for them to be able to send out at least so much free mail. I'm wondering what a good, strong conservative like you would say about that.
I think that's a great idea to get rid of the franking privilege. And it's just another example of how the incumbents designed the system to favor themselves, like the Citizens Election Program and those other fundraising systems that we have in Connecticut. They're all designed to help the people who do the designing. And that's not by accident.
You've been writing a lot, as have all of, everybody here has been writing a lot, but you've been writing a lot just about sort of the follow the money, trying to figure out where the money goes, who's funding what campaign. And I know one of the things you're figuring out is, you know, even such rules as do exist seem to be circumventable in interesting ways. Tell us what you found.
That's right. Connecticut has a much talked about state contractor ban and that prevents state contractors from contributing to candidates. And that's correct to a point. You can't directly contribute. But if you have a good lawyer or even a good journalist, you can figure out how to get around the rules. Because I've been able to track the way that the money can go to federal accounts, and that money is essentially interchangeable with the money in the state accounts. So it's a rule that exists but doesn't have an impact.
This it's all gotten incredibly complicated. Although my recollection, correct me if I'm wrong, the person who was the most eager and the most serious, I think, about trying to keep contractor and lobbyist money out of elections was Jody Rell.
Yes, that was Jody Rell was reluctant to embrace the idea of public financing, but she wanted a 100% ban on lobbyist and contractor contributions. She was counseled that the lobbyist 100% ban would probably not stand up in court. It did not. The court said you can restrict them, but not ban them. And on the case of contractors, the court said yes, there is a public case to be made, given Connecticut's recent history with corruption, some of it involving contractors, to ban contributions from contractors. And what that means, by the way, it's the principals and their spouses. You know, I've counted maybe $270,000 that contractors have given to the Democratic Party, but not all of that would have been banned, by the way. Some of that, I mean, these are money from people who work for state contractors. So it's a very complicated thing. I think it's a little bit more complicated than Zach described, that you just cut the check to the federal account. There are formulas as to what gets apportioned where. I have tried to master it, and I will admit to your listeners, I have failed.
And I'll agree with you, Mark, that it's complicated, and I think by design, because if we could all figure it out, if we could sit here and figure out, or average voters could figure it out, we would be more frustrated, and we would be disappointed in the way it was designed. So it's opaque by design, so that people can't see what's happening. And I think that defeats the purpose of the state contractor ban. I think it would be better if we knew that state contractor X gave politician Y $10,000 than having them to kind of circumvent or
well, it is recorded. I mean, you and I have written extensive stories about where the money is. I mean, I've done something pretty much every month. You do it frequently. So,
but who is it helping, though? I mean, is it helping the candidate for governor? Is it helping the candidate for Congress? Is it helping a candidate? And that's where it gets confusing.
There's no question that it's a two-track system, and that's part of the conflict here in Connecticut. You have public financing for the candidates. They're limited to $100 contributions. They're limited to what they can spend. But the state parties can raise $10,000 at a crack, and they can make unlimited expenditures. So,
and Daniela, some of that got changed two sessions ago, right?
Yeah, in the waning weeks, I think.
In the waning weeks, and in the governor's office, I think, really kind of helped design. What they said was a bill, but as usual, it was really one of those bills where we all looked at it and said, what?
Yeah.
You know, because it was, in fact, adjustments to a lot of different sections within the general statutes. And if one were a less trusting person than you and I are, one could look at that and say, they really are intentionally making this as confusing as they possibly can.
I remember Jerry Labriola coming up to the Capitol, and he's the Republican Party chair in the state, and he, you know, said this was great, and everybody was kind of scratching their heads. So why is this great for you guys? This is only going to help make the Democrats richer, and sure enough, that's kind of what happened.
There's an incredible opaqueness in how campaign finance laws are done. It is one of the most frustrating things to cover. There's a certain Senate Democratic staffer and I, we have this kind of hostile, friendly relationship over that, because I'm always accusing this person of actually writing the language and sticking it in there, and this person always just smiles, and I won't say what is implied in that smile, which is, you know, go do whatever. But I mean, that's how those laws are written. You know, it is very difficult to track who is responsible for the various lines and the rules that dictate how we raise money and fund elections.
Just to sort of piggyback on to what you're saying about those $100 amounts too, just to switch gears a tiny bit here, one of the developments since the last time the Wheelhouse convened was the dropping out of Mark Boughton, and Mark Boughton is basically dropping out for complicated reasons, which we'll sort of get into. But a lot of it has to do with the sheer difficulty of hitting those marks in the citizens' election program. And Daniela, you know, one of the things that we're watching, obviously, we're watching the citizens' election program, which is the official name for the public financing of candidacies, state candidacies in Connecticut. We're kind of watching it go through its growing pains. I mean, we saw really the first full campaign in the last cycle, and it's more highly developed this time around, and some of the wrinkles in it are becoming more and more apparent. But one of the things that's really becoming apparent when you look on the Republican side is just how damn difficult it is to raise $250,000 in $100 increments.
Yeah, and I think Boughton thought he had a brilliant strategy, team up with his running mate, do this together, and it just exploded because she decided, you know, that she didn't want to be part of it, and he was left high and dry at the very 11th hour. So really hurt him.
But then he teamed up with another running mate, right, Pass?
Yeah, that didn't quite work out so well because that running mate was not a candidate for lieutenant governor at the convention. Mark Loretti, the mayor of Shelton, he had to come out and quickly try to petition his way onto the ballot, and it's a tight time frame. He had to get 8,190 signatures by June 10th, and he didn't make it. He fell short. So Boughton was, left adrift without a fundraising partner. The question of, there was no science to the threshold amount. I think they got it right for the legislature. Maybe you could even tweak it a little bit higher. But for the statewide ones, it didn't sound like a lot of money, given that John Rowland would raise $5 or $6 million in the old system, but those were with big donations. Doing it $100 at a time, and you got to remember the idea behind it was you want people to go out and develop a base. You want them to be talking to the people, and I think for state reps and state senators, that's kind of the way it works. That has been a salutary effect of this, as opposed to going to your leadership and saying, "Cut me a check from the PAC," which you raised from lobbyists and other interests. So on the legislative stuff, there's some good stuff there. For statewide races, particularly for governor, that 250 mark has proved very difficult.
And I'm wondering about that, Zach. I realize the Yankee Institute may have a certain, overarching thoughts about the citizens' election program. But the reality is it exists right now. And if you don't get the financing, you're not a viable candidate. I mean, I think that's sort of fair to say. If you can't run against somebody who's getting millions of dollars that you just don't have access to, unless you're self-funding or have some other really terrific way, it's getting harder and harder for candidates who can't hit that mark to be viable candidates. So I don't know. Is it too hard? Is it too hard for a guy like – are they making it too hard for a guy like Boughton to qualify?
Well, I mean, I don't know about you, Colin, but I don't have 2,500 friends who would give me $100. And so really –
I don't have any friends who would give me $100.
Right. So – and really – so you're not even raising it in $100 increments. I mean, you can raise it up to $100, but you're raising it a lot. A lot of it is in smaller pieces. So it changes the nature of what political fundraising is. I mean, we think of congressmen and women calling people all afternoon for money, and they're calling people, specific people, saying, "Give me $1,000, $2,000, $3,000." Whereas in this case, you have to develop almost a field operation where you're going out and getting lots of people to find two friends to give you $20 each. And that's a really difficult logistical challenge.
But, there are consequences to whichever system is in place. And under the old system, where you can raise a max of $3,500 now, a couple of things. What we've seen is the choice seems to be self-funders or publicly financed, because people who do business with the state are restricted. So what does that say about the old system as to who really wants to cut $3,500 checks? But Boughton would have been in trouble either way, because arguably he might have been knocked out earlier because of, based on his showing in the polls, how many people were going to be writing those $3,500 checks. And under the old system, polls were hugely important. If you were not showing up in polls, your money dried up. And that was the downside of the old system. You did not get a chance to develop. So each of these systems, whichever way you go, there are obstacles, there are shortcomings,
Well, it'll be interesting to see as Jonathan Pelto gives the big money financing approach a test run this year, because as someone who I think philosophically is more in line with the CEP or taxpayer-funded elections, but someone who's trying to do it through the big-dollar donors, it'll be a good test of that approach.
Yeah, because he has no opportunity to qualify for the CEP. He'd have to get over 100,000 signatures and then raise that money. I think he also has to get a plover's egg that's growing at the feet of a giant or something. They make it really hard. It's like a fairy tale. Speaking of Mark Boughton, he did drop out. The mayor of Danbury, probably the most personable guy in Connecticut politics. Not that that's a particularly high bar to clear, but a fun guy to talk to. I talked to him earlier this week, and, you know, I mean, he and Tom Foley were running mates, Daniela, 4 years ago. And then afterwards, it really was kind of messy. They didn't get along so well post running mate experience. So I asked him this week on Monday about, you know, just how he feels about Foley. Nominally, he's endorsed Foley. Here's what he said.
Well, look, I think Tom Foley still needs to do a lot of work in his campaign. So I think that's a seminal question you asked, and I'm not sure I'd be the right person to be able to share that with you. I think Tom is a good man. He's an intelligent man. He's insightful. But just going around saying, I only lost by 6,500 votes, therefore you should vote for me this time around, is not going to win this election.
So probably they're not going to be appearing together on flatbed trucks around the state.
Yeah, it's an uncomfortable relationship. At least that's the way it appears. You know, Boughton is very personable, as you said, and Foley cuts a very different figure. Sort of publicly, he's very cautious and very vanilla and very sort of unwilling to show a lot of personality. I mean, with Boughton, you wonder how much of it is shtick and how much of it is real. But you know, it does come across at least as very engaging, and he appears to have a lot of charisma, whereas, you know, Foley really doesn't at this point.
Some of their ill will started out because Foley was sort of saying, well, he had the wrong running mate last time. If he'd had a woman, he would have done so much better. He has a 2 out of 3 chance of having a woman running mate this time.
And I think, you know, it goes to deeper divisions in the Republican Party. I mean, the party was ripped apart by Linda McMahon twice. You know, you had the establishment figures on one side and you had the sort of, you know, big money newcomers on the other side. And, you know, while Foley is not has said at least he's not going to, you know, fully fund his campaign as a multimillionaire from Greenwich. That didn't work too well for Linda McMahon. You know, he is sort of that wing of the party, and you know, he's a newcomer. And then you have Boughton, someone who spent years in the trenches, and so there's still, I think, repercussions from those really divisive primaries.
You know, Mark Boughton, let's be honest, Mark Boughton never liked Tom Foley. That was a shotgun marriage. It was our screwy primary system where the candidates for governor and lieutenant governor run independently of each other. So you ended up with this kind of, you know, miscast pair. You know, Boughton from day one had run as the blue-collar guy who loved tweaking everything about Foley, being from Greenwich, being going to Harvard, his money. But it was weird. I mean, Boughton, when he pulled out, he urged the party to unite behind Tom Foley, which was like one of the biggest political non-sequiturs I've ever heard. And when I asked him for his rationale, he said, well, you got to respect the convention process. I said, Mark, if you respected the convention process, you wouldn't have been trying to run a primary.
Let me just follow up with you. You reported this week, Paz, about kind of what I thought was kind of a remarkable thing, which is that Tom Foley, on the strength of all this, despite the fact that there's this tiny little guerrilla movement up in the hills called John McKinney and David Walker, they're still, you know, nominally in the primary hunt, he kind of moved in, right, in terms of taking over the state party and said, look, I'm putting my fundraising people in here and, you know, and in the words of Al Haig, I'm in charge.
Well, he did learn something from 4 years ago, that party organizations are worth something, that ground games are worth something. And he and the other Republicans have been looking at what Governor Malloy has been doing with the Democratic Party. You know, Malloy is the first governor probably since, you know, Bill O'Neill, who has devoted any time to building a party organization. Now, a lot of it self-serving, to be sure. But the effort is there, and the results are there. They have a significant staff, a significant network of volunteers. And so Foley decided quite rightly, I can't wait till after the primary. So, but the interesting thing is how he cast it. I mean, Jerry Labriola, I think, quite smartly said, well, whatever Tom does by helping us with fundraising, it will benefit whomever wins on August 12th. And that is true. Tom, on the other hand, said, well, I won the convention, so the party doesn't have to be neutral. And that's not exactly the way the bylaws work. But, you know, he clearly is putting a stamp on it. And the message is to donors, okay, this party organization is now an extension of my campaign. I'm publicly financed, or he hopes to be approved this afternoon for public financing. So cut those checks to the Republican Party.
Right. The message to donors is this, and this is with both parties, is you've already given your $100 to the governor candidate. Now give as much as you want, up to $10,000 to the party. And that money will go to the same purpose.
And I assume you don't object to that. I mean, you know, he's got to do this to get on the same footing with Malloy, who, as Paz is suggesting, is really miles ahead of him at this point, at least on that front.
Yeah, I don't necessarily – the tactics of it is – I mean, I don't have a place to object to that. I'm just objecting to sort of the laughable system we have where you get the taxpayer money and then you get to raise as much money as you want anyway. So we're kind of you get your cake and to eat it too.
Can't disagree with you. All right. We're going to take a quick break if you want to chime in on the conversations we're having. We're going to switch gears a little bit in the next segment, talk a little bit about Jonathan Pelto, talk a little bit about yesterday was Joe Lieberman Day. Somewhere in the world, it's always Joe Lieberman Day. We'll come back after this. All right. Welcome back to The Wheelhouse. In the room with me is Zach Jarnowski. He's an investigative reporter for the Yankee Institute. From the Red Sox Institute, Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, and Danielle Altomare, could be a Mets fan for all we know, State House reporter for the Hartford Current. Probably not a Mets fan, actually. That's never a good bet. All right. As we talk about what we talk about, please feel free to call in 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. So yesterday was Joe Lieberman Day in Connecticut. Not officially a pass, but he does have a reason to come back here and hand out some scholarship money, right?
He does. It started with excess campaign funds. You get to do various things with those. And he chose to start a scholarship fund. So he awarded five $1,500 scholarships last year. He renewed those this year and awarded five more. But what it turns out to be is it's sort of a day to catch up with Joe and for everybody to write the "Where is he now?" story. What is he doing? And is he still annoying Barack Obama over Iraq as well as much of the Democratic base?
Which he didn't do yesterday, actually.
No. He was critical but in a very measured way. And he complimented President Obama's Secretary of State for trying to build a new coalition to try to bring Iraq to heal again with the, you know, with the various sectarian violence. And he complimented the president on at least being open to sending advisors. But he did say in a measured way, you know, if we had kept a force of 10,000 or so there, as he and others had suggested, perhaps Iraq would not be unraveling the way it is now.
Well, one of the other things he was asked about is third-party candidacies. And back in 2006, he actually wound up starting the Connecticut for Lieberman Party, having failed to win a primary against Ned Lamont. So somebody, could have been you for all I know, wanted to know, you know, how he felt about the candidacy of Jonathan Pelto, who's doing kind of the same thing, although we have a little clip here where Joe Lieberman was at pains to point out that it's not really exactly the same thing.
I didn't voluntarily choose to run as an independent. I was forced to do so to try to give all the people in the state at least a chance to decide whether I should stay as a senator. So it's harder to run as an independent.
And so on the other hand, we have another clip here where he talked about really in the spirit of Joni Mitchell, he'd looked at third-party candidacies from both sides now. This was his other experience with third-party candidacies.
One of the reasons that that was so close in Florida, I believe, was that there was a third-party candidate named Ralph Nader. And, you know, arguably, if Ralph hadn't been in the race, Al Gore and I would have won more clearly in Florida. So what I'm saying is that third-party candidates can affect the outcome of elections. That's the point of it.
Not that he's bitter. But the immediate response, Daniela, from the Pelto campaign, I think you probably got the same email I did this morning saying, so sometimes they're really bad and sometimes they're really good, right?
Yeah, that's Pelto.
and you know, Zach Janowski, as we look at a situation like this, this is one of the burdens that Pelto has, though. He has to constantly address this question of whether or not he's a spoiler. Is he Ralph Nader or is he, I guess, or is he Joe Lieberman in 2006, somebody who's got every right to the same right as everybody else to seek the same seat? And I don't know. Is it fair that Pelto is constantly having to answer this spoiler question?
I mean, I think he wants to be a spoiler, and whether he wins and spoils it that way, or whether he loses and spoils it that way, I mean, I think either way, he will advance his goals and his objectives. So, I mean, I don't think he would call himself a spoiler because that's not politically smart. But I think that's what he is, and he wants to show that he's keeping people honest. And sort of like, I mean, you look at what happened in Virginia with the House Majority Leader losing to a Republican candidate in a primary who wanted to keep the House Majority Leader committed to certain principles. And I think that's what Pelto is concerned about. He has certain principles, and he doesn't think Malloy is sticking with him.
Now, one thing that has happened is that first of all, if you listen to, say, I don't know, conservative, if you listen to the Reverend Will Marotti on WTIC, he's like the biggest Jonathan Pelto fan ever. Well, that Jonathan Pelto makes a lot of sense. And we also discovered, I think through the reporting of Mark Pasniokas, Zach, this week, that Jonathan Pelto and my friend Chris Healy, former Republican state chairman, they sat down for coffee. They talked. And Healy walked away with a plan to maybe help a little bit with petitions. Does that wind up seeming a little bit more cynical, or is that still okay?
I think it can have that appearance, but I know Jonathan Pelto a little bit, and I think that we both think that the system is broken and we both want to change it. We might have slightly different views about how to do that, but we're sort of anti-status quo, and that makes us sometimes in the same camp, even though we have different views about exactly how to change the system.
And I think Paz's story, if I'm remembering correctly, pointed out that maybe Pelto might take some votes away from Foley. I mean, they both are making the same noise on Common Core.
Yeah.
I don't think Chris Healy thinks that.
No,
Chris Healy doesn't think that. But there's a couple things about Jonathan. Everybody has a right to run. Jonathan set himself up, though, to a higher standard. And the reason he is going to constantly face questions about being a spoiler is when he started exploring this, he said quite explicitly, I will only do this if I can be a credible candidate, if I have a shot of winning, that I do not want to do it simply to draw votes away from Dan Malloy, with whom I disagree on education and some aspects of tax policy. So that's how – those are the rules he set. So now he has put himself in the position of having to make the case that with, a band of volunteers, hey, kids, let's put on a show. We're going to do what only Lowell Weicker and Joe Lieberman have been able to do with the advantages of, in Lieberman's case, incumbency. And I will never stop saying this, and a $20 million budget. And in Lowell Weicker's case, in effect, the advantages of incumbency, and that he had only been out of office for 2 years. So that's why Jonathan will always get those spoiler questions. But if he had said, as he is now starting to say, by credible I mean somebody who can credibly raise issues, absolutely. He has the right to do that. Ralph Nader had the right to do that in 2000, as did Patrick Buchanan, who everybody forgets also was on the ballot in Florida and drew some votes away from Bush, presumably.
Yeah, I mean, and we could go back to 92 where Ross Perot, really did play. I think he got 19% of the vote that year.
Yeah, absolutely.
So these things can become important. Now, Chris Healy, he did, I think, just to be fair and to represent his view as fairly as possible, Paz, I think he did tell you, well, he had kind of a longstanding relationship with Jonathan Pelto. And as Zach is saying, some of their critiques of the system are similar, and he knows Jonathan. And so why not? Why not just help a brother?
Chris is 100% clear on why he's doing it. That this would quote, as the email that somebody forwarded me, that Chris wrote to Republicans in Weathersfield, this will bleed votes away from Dan Malloy. So, Chris has a very clear agenda. This is going to bleed votes from Dan Malloy. And if things stay as close as they are now, Malloy and Foley, if Foley is the nominee, they've been in dead heats in back-to-back polls. Not statistical dead heats, actual dead heats.
One of the ways, Daniela, that that Jonathan Pelto, and we talked about this last week too, sooner or later, he's going to matter if he's on stage with Dan Malloy and presumably with Tom Foley. He's going to matter then.
Yeah, and so the question is, you know, when the debates happen in September and October, you know, what role he'll play then? And that's a huge forum for him, and that's when people are actually paying attention. I don't know who's paying attention now to all this stuff.
But,
yeah, apart from us. But, you know, certainly in September and October, you've got, you know, the Channel 8 debate down at the Guard Theater in New London at 7 o'clock, you know, on TV. He's going to have a big voice then.
I think that's Malloy's biggest concern. I think they're less concerned about the actual votes that he draws, because you can make the case that if you're going to turn out to vote for Pelto, you're turned off from Malloy. You're not going to – now, that's not one-to-one. That won't be all votes. But I think the bigger concern is that, you know, Pelto is adept at raising these issues. He knows the media. And there's a bit of chaos in what – Malloy would prefer to be a two-person race, the choice between him and Tom Foley, particularly when you're talking to the Democratic base. I think that's the bigger issue for Malloy.
You know, by the way, if you're paying attention to this show or to the political race, or if you're paying attention to anything, feel free to give us a call, 860-275-7266. It would give us such a reassuring feeling that we weren't talking about something that no one cares about. 860-275-7266. We know you care. We know you care passionately. So we haven't seen them on the same stage yet, Paz, but this week they didn't even have like a mid-air near miss or anything like that. But I think, as you pointed out, they actually used the same microphone. Jonathan Pelto and Dan Malloy, they were, what, a couple hours apart maybe or something like that, the working families?
Yes. Yeah. Lieutenant Governor Wyman, who, it should be said, once was very close friends with Pelto. They were colleagues in the legislature. I believe she may have performed his marriage. yeah, this is like a bad soap opera. So Wyman and Malloy spoke early, and then Pelto was at the very end. And it was the other sort of bit of soap opera here is the same unions that did not let him speak at the AFL-CIO, the same unions that dominate the AFL-CIO. By the way, they dominate the Working Families Party. But the rules are a little different, and they opened the mics to all the candidates. John McKinney came. Tom Foley did not. But Pelto got, you know, Pelto got his 9 minutes cumulatively or whatever they gave him. So that gave him his moment in the sun.
And Zach, you know, one of the sort of the subtexts here is, you know, we think about third parties as being these kinds of lost causes, or they don't last very long. A Connecticut party was Lowell Weicker's party. Connecticut for Lieberman got hijacked by people who didn't even like Joe Lieberman and then kind of fizzled out here. But, you know, part of the subtext of this is that slowly but surely there is something called the Working Families Party, and one does – at least in some instances, depending on who one is, Tom Foley elected not to, but one does go there. I think John McKinney went, right?
John McKinney went. Yeah. Foley did not.
Yeah, I think that the one interesting point, I think there were 50 people at the Working Families Convention. I read that in one of the reports. So it's a small but persistent group. And it is interesting. Certainly, it sounded like Pelto felt more at home there. Which could lead to an interesting outcome if Pelto is ultimately gets their endorsement. And McKinney, I think, took the opportunity to try to make himself out to be the conservative alternative to Tom Foley, which if Senator McKinney was talking like candidate McKinney, then I think our state would be in a different position.
We got an email from Dan. If Foley loses, who is on the Republican bench 4 years from now? Any of the lieutenant governor candidates or just Foley again? Similar for the Democrats, if Malloy loses, would Kevin Lembo or Denise Merrill be gubernatorial? I don't know if I can stand to talk about 2018. I'm having enough trouble with 2014 right now. But, I mean, Zach, it's a fair question with the Republicans anyway. I mean, Foley may very well win, and then it's a moot point. But in terms of developing candidates, it seems as though they've been stuck in a groove with Foley and McMahon and a couple of people like that. It might be fair to ask, you know, how good is the bench? Is Bakayaki or any of these other people, are they going to emerge as statewide candidates?
I think some of the lieutenant governor candidates could take that step. I think the bigger problem with the Republicans is that Republicans have an over-promotion problem where they take people who show signs of success. They're youthful, they're smart, they have success on a small level, and people instantly think that they should be, you know, Secretary General of the UN, when maybe we should take some intermediate steps to develop them and test them and make sure they're really as qualified as they look when they're on the school board. And that's, I think, the problem that the Republican Party has faced, that we're taking people and dropping them in at high races. And then they – and actually, there were a couple instances of candidates in the 2nd District who ran for U.S. Congress and then backtracked and ran for the state legislature, which if they had done it in reverse, maybe they would have had more success.
All right. We got a call from Marianne in a car. We're going to have to go to a break here pretty soon, and Daniela has to leave. She's getting some stem cells from the Malloy administration. So here's Marianne in a car. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm just fine. How are you?
Good. I am a teacher in Connecticut, in public school teacher, and we did not support Malloy in the primary, and when he was elected, he did many things that were anti-teacher, and he's also had to backpedal because he still wants our support. I do not trust. I voted for him. I will not vote for him again. I will not vote for Foley. I am taking a serious look at Mr. Pelto because he's paying it as it is. And I would hope that he does not have a hidden agenda, because he seems to me to be a very good alternative to Malloy. And if Malloy gets in again, I don't trust what he will do to our teaching profession.
All right. Yes, go ahead, Bows. Yeah.
Can I ask a question? So is your choice right now to not vote?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Is your choice right now not to vote for governor or to vote for Pelto? Is that where you are, that there's no way you'd vote for Malloy and Foley, so Pelto sort of gives you an outlet, a place to go?
Correct.
Okay.
I mean, the question obviously is, how many Mariannes are there out there? And are any of them connected to any other issue besides education and teaching? I mean, that's really, you know, I think a couple weeks ago, Paz was on, and I said that Pelto and his running mate looked like a 21st century team, and Paz said, no, they look like a single issue team. And you know, Daniel, that's the million-dollar question, right? Is Pelto attractive to anybody else except a disgruntled teacher or a disgruntled parent of a disgruntled public school student?
Which, you know, admittedly are huge groups of people.
Right, not insignificant, yeah.
You know, he's making noise about, you know, Malloy's corporate welfare and things like that, and as is Foley, by the way, which is kind of interesting. You know, so there's criticism on the governor's economic policy. I mean, just on the working families thing, you know, it's kind of interesting that they're making a play for the endorsements. I think most people expect that Malloy will get it. But the Working Families Party has been a huge force of late. Look what's happening in New York. I mean, it's really interesting. And, you know, they probably feel a great debt to Malloy because he did sign their, you know, signature piece of legislation, paid sick leave, and they probably will endorse him. But, you know, the fact that only 50 people showed up at their convention on a Saturday in June, I don't think that should necessarily tells us anything about their clout in the state and in the region.
But their clout, in some ways, they're not a real political party.
No,
the sense of they trying to enroll people as registered working families people.
Yeah.
Most of the working families executives are registered Democrats.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, you know, it's fusion politics. It's common in New York.
Does work better in New York. Exactly.
Yeah, but they're, you know, their motto has been, it's the protest vote that counts for the people. It's a way to try to push the Democratic Party to the left a little bit. It's a labor thing. And as far as them getting the endorsement, it's the same unions that are endorsing Malloy. They're the ones who fund the working family. So I think we can assume reasonably that Dan Malloy will be getting the endorsement of the working family.
But they can make things. They can certainly make things difficult. Look what happened in Bridgeport.
All right. We have to take a little break here. I love a Working Families Party convention in June. How about you? We'll be back after this. All right. This is Colin McEnroe. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm sitting in for John Dankosky. He is receiving medical treatment after being bitten by Luis Suarez. But he's fine. He's fine. They just wash out the – it's the emotional. It's a shock, I think, more than anything else. But he needed to compose himself after that. He'll be back tomorrow, actually, and he'll be talking about the ongoing story of the New Britain Rockcats' planned move to Hartford. He'll talk to I'm just laughing because it's just been so much fun to watch this one unfold. He'll be talking to Hartford Mayor Pedro Segarra.
Unfold or unravel?
Or unravel. It's now becoming more of a struggle to find out something about this that really is the way it was presented as opposed to anything else. I think there might be one or two details which have held up. He'll talk to Hartford Mayor Pedro Segarra, Development Director Tom Deller, and City Council President Sean Wooden. If Mr. Dankowski were here today, he'd ask me what I'm doing. Today on the show, it's about nonverbal communication. There's this amazing novel called The Silent History about a generation of people, some of whom are born without the ability to speak or write or understand words at all. And so that kind of got us thinking. We're going to have one of the authors of that novel, also a mime, of course, and a linguist who studies children who, for one reason or another, are born into situations where there is no spoken language. So anyway, that'll be great on radio, right? Nonverbal communication.
I was just thinking only Colin McEnroe would do a radio show on nonverbal communication.
Bad ideas attract us. Mark Pazniokas is in the studio. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Zach Janowski, investigative reporter for the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, joining us now. And she now has her own theme music, at least when she's reporting about the Vatican. Here's our WNPR business reporter, Harriet Jones. Harriet, we're gonna cue up your music right now because you kind of moved into Dan Brown territory. His next novel, I think, is called Angels in HVAC. Here's your music. All right, that's actually music from the Sistine Chapel, not live from the Sistine Chapel. Now, why would a Connecticut business reporter at all care about what goes on in the Sistine Chapel? Harriet, explain this for us.
Classiest theme music ever. I love it. Thank you very much.
Well, it's a break from the usual bagpipes we play for you.
So. Right, exactly. A change of image. So, yeah, this was a really interesting story that broke in the last week or so that Carrier, which is based in Farmington, it's part of United Technologies, is going to replace the HVAC system in the Sistine Chapel. And I guess a lot of us had never thought that, of course, the Sistine Chapel has to have an HVAC system. The previous one was put in by Carrier also, done in the 1990s, when there were far fewer visitors. It was maybe 1.5 million visitors at that point each year to the Sistine Chapel. That has grown just exponentially. There is now about 6 million visitors a year to the Sistine Chapel. They bring in on their feet the dust. They're sweating in there. They're breathing in there is one of the biggest problems. The amount of carbon dioxide people are breathing out into the atmosphere in the Sistine Chapel is really having an impact on the Michelangelo frescoes, some of the most famous art in the world. The Vatican is very concerned about this. They've called in Carrier to give them a custom solution.
And I think we have a little tape here from that, right?
Yeah.
United Technologies.
Go ahead. Yeah, we'll play the tape, and then you can tell us what we're hearing.
United Technologies is helping to protect one of the most sacred indoor environments on Earth. If you think about history, throughout time, art has defined who we are as a society. And so by preserving art, we're preserving the record of humanity. And we can't be more proud to serve this role at this installation.
So, Harriet Jones, this is a nice moment for UTC. I mean, you know, and just in terms of one's public image, and I mean, there can't be a more plum gig than that, right? They're trusting
Absolutely,
you with a Sistine
yes.
Chapel, right?
I mean, nothing more high profile in the world than that, right? That was John Mandyke. He's from UTC Building and Control Systems, which is the kind of overarching parent of Carrier. And he's the lucky man who got to go to Rome to go and, you know, do the press launch of the system. They've actually started building it already. It's going to be ready in October. They have donated this system to the Vatican, so there is no monetary benefit to them, but the publicity benefit to them is really immeasurable. He says they're using a system, all the technology that they're using is technology that they use in their, their residential and commercial systems currently. But it has to be put together in a way that is custom built for the Sistine because of its high vaulted ceilings, because of the need to have minimal airflow past those frescoes.
You know how when contractors come to your house, they also want to put their sign out on the lawn?
Yeah.
Did they ask the Pope whether they could do that or not?
Right in the middle of St. Peter's Square, I think. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, you know, on another business front, and we really are, you know that phrase, from the sacred to the profane?
Yeah,
we are making that transition right now from the Sistine Chapel to the Back Nine Network. First of all, you might have to explain.
Well, golf is a religion to some people, Colin.
That's true, absolutely.
You know?
I stay with my trope, though. I'm holding with my trope. This is from the sacred to the occasionally profane. So, Harriet, first of all, explain to people about the Back Nine Network.
So Back Nine Network is a startup. I guess content provider might be the best way to put it. It started up in Hartford in 2011, producing what they call golf lifestyle programming. And what they've been so far is a content provider in search of they call themselves a network, but they're not really a network because they haven't been on TV. They've been putting out their programming on the internet and on mobile apps. But the big news for them this week is they did sign a TV deal. They're going to be on DirecTV, which is going to put their golf lifestyle content in front of 20 million sets of eyeballs, which is a very big deal for them.
You know, Paz, the Back Nine Network, in some ways it kind of makes sense if you're trying to develop a TV and sports entertainment culture rotating around the huge access of ESPN. But the fact that this enterprise does get some state money occasionally has raised some eyebrows, right?
Yeah, I thought, instead of producing programming, they've been producing fodder for political columnists and bloggers since the state wrote some checks, in part because of some off-color stuff that they've produced for their web content. But yeah, it does fit in the broadest sense with the state's idea that we are a friendly location for digital media, ESPN, NBC Sports. And like those two giant institutions, yeah, there's some state money on the table for these guys too.
Well, but now if you have DirecTV and you can find Channel 262, you can watch this programming. But, Zach, this is sort of the double-edged sword, too, and I could probably intuit what the Yankee Institute's attitude towards some of this stuff is. But, as you're dumping money into private enterprise in order to create a certain kind of business climate, you take certain risks.
Absolutely. And I think that it just goes to show that we'd be better off if we made everyone better off instead of specific businesses. I mean, I looked at what we just talked about, UTC. UTC just got a big $400 million tax deal. We could have reduced the corporate tax rate for every business in the state by a quarter point and had the same revenue loss. So it would have had the same impact. So if we backed out all these deals where we give the first five and the second five and the third five, and the hedge funds all this money, if we took all that money back and reduced taxes, every business would have had a tax cut, and I think that would be a smarter approach.
All right. We're going to have to stop there. Thanks very much to Harriet Jones. Thanks to Zach Janowski, to Mark Pazniokas, and to Daniela Altomare. I'm going to just quickly close with one last observation, and that is that here in Hartford, the acclaimed poet Wallace Stevens lived in the west end of Hartford. He lived on Westerly Terrace. He never learned to drive. And he walked to his job at the Hartford Insurance Group every day, walked home. There's actually a little route that's now described and marked with verses from 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. But if you really want to participate in some ways, this kind of under-celebrated, a gigantic figure in the world of literature who is from Hartford, all you have to do is pony up $489,900 or maybe make a better deal than that to buy his 3,900-square-foot home with 6 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, built on a half acre in the west end of Hartford. It's a 1920s colonial. It's probably something that we should have preserved privately somehow or other, but it actually belonged to the Episcopal Diocese, and they're putting it on the market. So we're going to have to say goodbye to you. We may have to say goodbye to Wallace Stevens's beautiful home. The house was quiet and the world was calm. The reader became the book, and summer night was like a conscious being of the book. It's a Wallace Stevens poem about a house. Who knew?
I'm Jeremy Hobson, the hip-hop